east up to Mount Hood, all of Hood River County, and parts of East Multnomah County, east of Gresham. I chair the Senate Business Transportation Committee. This is one of the busiest committees in the Oregon Legislature because we're doing both business issues and transportation issues. And generally speaking, you have a business committee and a transportation committee. But because I got such talented colleagues, the Senate President decided you guys need to handle all of these issues. And my colleagues have worked on these issues for a long time, have a lot of experience on it. And we are really anxious to come to Milwaukee to have an opportunity to hear from you on some of these issues. We tried to select a couple of the bills that we're working on that you might have an interest in. And unlike just another forum that you might go to, this is an actual committee. We will actually be passing or not passing pieces of legislation that are going to become part of Oregon law that will impact you. And that's why we are really anxious to have your input on that and actually see how the process works. We have one of the senators will be joining us in a moment, but what I'll do is I'm going to start with Senator George. He'll tell you who he represents, and then Senator Starr, and then we'll begin our workload for the morning.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Larry George, State Senator from Senate District 13. My district reaches out towards Hag Lake, out towards Forest Grove, sweeps around through Sherwood, Wilsonville, Newburgh, St. Paul, and the Kaiser area.
I'm Senator Bruce Starr, and I represent Western Washington County. I live in Hillsboro, and I represent the communities of Hillsboro, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains in Western Washington County. Glad to be here this morning.
Great. Thank you, Senators. And hopefully we'll have a very, very productive morning, and I know you have your time schedule as well, so we're going to move right into our agenda. And I'm going to move things around a little bit because I know we have quite a few people signed up on Senate Bill 397, so I'm going to start with that one this morning. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 397. And I'm remiss at the moment. So Janet Atkins is our committee administrator. She does a sensational job of working with us and organizing today. And if you would want to introduce your companion, and then we'll get into the bill definition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I grew up in Medford, home of the Black Tornado, and have lived in Salem. Went to the University of Oregon and have lived in Salem since 77. And this is Adam Hicks, the committee assistant who runs the computer. Everything is being taped, and you'll be able to listen to the meeting in the future if you want to by going to the legislature's website. You can tell your teacher how to do that if you want to listen or have your parents or friends listen. I think also some of the things that we're not being broadcast on the Oregon Channel, but other committee meetings at the legislature are. So Adam's running the tape equipment and keeping track of when people talk, and so that will all be available to you in the future. And do you want me to say anything about the bill?
Let's go ahead and go on to 397.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 397 would require that school districts and private schools notify DMV if students between the ages of 15 and 18 have more than 10 consecutive or 15 total days of unexcused absence during a semester. And then it would require the school district or private school to have a policy allowing students to appeal that decision to notify DMV. Not a part of the bill, but at your place today in your packets are the statutes that are related to Senate Bill 397, because what the bill itself doesn't say is that there's another statute that when DMV receives this notice, they're required to give the student 30 days, and then their driver's license would be suspended. Under current law, school districts have the option to notify DMV when there's this period of unexcused absence, but they aren't required to. What Senate Bill 397 would do would be to require school districts to notify DMV, and then DMV would be required to start the suspension process. Mr. Chair, I think also at your place you have some testimony. I'll have our honorary page pass it out if not.
Okay.
And from a joint testimony from the Oregon School Boards Association and the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators.
Okay, thank you very much. Our first witness will be the constituent of Senator Morris, who is bringing this bill to us. Her name is Cynthia Mars, and Cynthia, if you'd like to come forward and give us your testimony. Welcome, and thanks for coming all the way up from Philomath this morning.
Thank you very much. I'm excited and nervous to be here. This...
Well, state your name, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Cynthia Mars, M-A-R-R-S. This piece of legislation, or a piece very, very similar to it, is working wonders in Florida. My very best friend lives in Florida. And we were talking about it on the phone one day, and she said, you know, our dropout rate is coming down. And that makes perfect sense to me on a whole bunch of levels. My son is here with me today. I also have a daughter. Keeping him in school was not a big problem. Keeping her in school was very, very difficult. And so I can see some real benefits for this. Driving is an important privilege to our youth. It's not a right, it's a privilege. And every privilege, in my mind, needs to have some responsibilities that come with it. And so, if one of those responsibilities is to take advantage of their opportunity for education, knowing that we as a society feel that educated youth will make much more productive adults, then everybody wins. This isn't a want to make life difficult for children who have other circumstances. I understand that other circumstances come up. That's why there's the appeal process. If a youth needs to be out for illness, maternity leave, any of those sorts of things, that's taken into account. We're talking about kids who have just, for one reason or another, decided that they don't want to go to school anymore. That's fine. They also would have the opportunity to go and go get a GED. If you go get your GED, fine. You're off the hook. But if you don't want to go to school and you don't have a reason for not wanting to go to school and you can't pass the GED, if you can't pass the GED, you need to find your happy little self back in school. It's just not that hard to pass. So it's, to my mind, a good thing. It's giving children who maybe don't see the importance of an education or that piece of paper and what that can mean for them later. If a kid needs to be out of school for family reasons because they need to work, a GED is going to give them opportunities to get better jobs. If they simply just for time reasons can't stay in school. So I feel strongly about this. I think it's important. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Mars. Now, under current law, the school district can exercise this program now. Did your children both go to Philomath High School?
No. My son went to Corvallis High School. I'm sorry, Crescent Valley. My daughter went to Corvallis.
Okay. Does either Crescent Valley or Corvallis utilize the program, permissive program, today?
No. And I, as a matter of fact, as I said, my daughter was at Corvallis High School. And she was really, really struggling. Really struggling for lots of reasons with lots of other issues. Her school counselor actually advised her to drop out, which just made me crazy.
Did you talk to them at all, either school, about the program, about why they don't participate in the notification part?
I did not. I didn't realize that this hearing was going to sneak up on me quite as fast as it did.
Yeah. Oh, that happens to a lot of people. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Mars? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll ask Mr. Ron Nasel, Superintendent of North Platte School District, please. And before we begin Mr. Nasel's testimony, we have been joined by our other senator on this committee, Senator Lori Montes Anderson. Senator Montes Anderson, if you'd like to tell the group who you are, who you represent in the Oregon Legislature.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm late. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I actually represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. I'm a nurse by trade. I actually worked for Oregon City High School for 3 years as a clinic nurse, so I have been very involved in high schools for a period of my nursing career. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And I believe at one time was chair of the Gresham-Barlow School Board.
I was. And I was also on the Oregon School Boards Association, too. So schools are dear to my heart.
And with that, Superintendent Nasel, thank you very much, first of all, for accommodating us in your district today.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, welcome. Welcome to the North Clackamas School District, and more specifically, welcome to Milwaukee High School, a school with a proud and rich history. We're glad to have you among the Mustangs today. On this very sunny day at Milwaukee High School, I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to the legislature, if what I read in the newspaper is accurate, for the final passage of the Rainy Day Fund. From the standpoint of the North Clackamas School Board, from the standpoint of this superintendent, anything that this state can do to buffer the cyclical economy and that can perhaps help us to smooth out what this school district has gone through over the last 4 years has to be noted as a blessing. I know there's a lot of disagreement as to how one should have gotten to the Rainy Day Fund, and I'll not get into that particular set of discussions, but it is good that we have, at least it appears, that we're very close to having the beginnings of that Rainy Day Fund. So I would like to thank everyone involved. Senate Bill 397, I'm coming forward in opposition to Senate Bill 397. And there are, I think, three basic comments that I would want to make about it. This legislation replaces enabling legislation with mandated legislation. And just on a purely political sense of local control and decisions that ought to be made in school districts, it troubles us that that a bill which does, in fact, allow school districts to do or to take these types of actions is being proposed as saying that school districts must do this. We believe that if a problem exists, that enabling legislation is the best way to go, that local school boards ought to have the opportunity to make that decision. We think that's present in the current legislation. I recognize, and I'm certainly not being critical of the instincts or the intentions of those who have prepared this bill, there is certainly a great frustration with things like dropout rates and other behaviors that that people see amongst some, a small percentage of our youngsters. However, I would just want to say that frustration is probably not a good driver of legislation, in particular case this legislation. I'm reminded, and I've lost the name of the gentleman to whom this quote is attributed, but I will just give the quote. For every complex issue, there is a simple answer, and it is wrong. The whole issue of school dropouts is a complex issue. And it seems to me that trying to solve that problem by taking or involving the school districts with the Department of Motor Vehicles in terms of removing driving rights is not a good solution to that problem. Why? Effectively, first of all, it creates another level, if you would, of bureaucracy is not the word I want, but another level of documentation and support for documentation that again falls on the shoulders of a school district. And not only falls on the shoulders of a school district, but has to be coordinated with another agency that is responsible for a host of data. We don't have the luxury of being connected. We don't have integrated data systems here. One of the things I note in this bill is that in an effort to deal with the exceptions, if you would, to this sort of blanket process, there is or there would be mandated an appeals process. I would just hope that you as legislators would understand that when an appeals process is mandated, that creates a tremendous burden on resources. because that appeals process then has to have a whole set of documentations of its own right, notification, scheduling of appeals. Who is it that we appeal to? If it truly is to the school district board, then that means that seven elected members of a community who do not work full-time for the school district in that sense are going to have to find time to come together for appeals hearings. This gets to be a very complex system and a tremendous demand on resources. I think there is probably something instructive to the legislature in the results of the enabling legislation. This was put in place. School districts were told you can do this if you feel a need to do it. Our school district has not taken up that option. I would hope that the legislature would understand that we are not necessarily wrong in not taking advantage of the opportunity. We think it was a decision that was made on our part for a lot of very positive reasons. For all of the things that I've said, we're opposed to Senate Bill 397, and I will leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Naso. Questions for Superintendent Naso? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I wasn't sure if you. Sorry,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, if you could for us walk through what would be normal procedures. When we have students that are consistently absent, missing school, a lot of times parents don't know about this. And can you just kind of walk through current procedures that your district does so that we have an understanding of what, I mean, because what we're really trying to do here is try to make sure kids go to school.
I understand.
And so we're trying to give you all the tools we possibly can. So if you could walk through for us how you think your current program's working and maybe what are some alternatives to this that would work for us.
Well, first of all, on the notification piece, and I should say, as superintendent of the schools, there's someone in this room, I think he's still in this room, the principal of the school, who's probably in a little bit better position to explain to you the procedures. But we do have notifications that go to parents automatically when we have extended absences, when we have significant they can give better details, but significant absence due to unexcused absences. I don't believe that we would have many situations, I would suspect very few situations, where students are not in school and that is not known to their parents. We don't ignore that situation. We also have a capability in our school district for parents to monitor a child's attendance via computer from home. That's all on our ESA system, our student information system. So from the standpoint of notification and knowledge of, I think we're fairly well down the road. The larger issue is what, if anything, we can do about that. Sometimes we're successful with counseling. Sometimes we're not successful with counseling. I know it was mentioned earlier that a counselor in some setting advised the student to leave school. I don't know the circumstances of that, but I'm not here to tell you that that has never happened in the North Blackman School District, because my guess is that there are some circumstances. That's why I say this is a very complex situation. There are some circumstances where it may well, on a temporary basis, be in the best interest of a child to be away from school for an extended period of time. Now, we try to hook them up with alternative schools, evening schools, that sort of thing. But we have some avenues available to us. The driver's license is seductive because, I mean, we as adults, we all operate on the premise that the one thing that youngsters live for more than anything else is to be able to drive their cars. And I think that we're probably 80% right on that. However, the reality that taking their driver's licenses away from them will necessarily, in our worst-case situations, keep youngsters from driving still has to be tested. And that certainly is one of the complicating factors in all of this.
One quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my last follow-up to you is, if this wasn't an unfunded mandate, if the legislature was to come up with the dollars necessary to implement this program, so you felt like you were fully compensated for the notification and the appeals process and the additional staff time it would take to deal with that, would you still be opposed to, if it was not an unfunded mandate but actually a funded mandate, would it change your attitude towards the effectiveness of the program? Because the testimony we just heard before, according to the documentation our staff gave us, Portland Public School estimates that 10.6 of their student population would fit the suspension criteria. And to me, that's kind of a shocking number. That 10% of their students are perpetually absent is just kind of a shocking amount, because we're paying, you know, the state's paying for those kids to be in school, and they're not getting the education. So somehow the state's coming up with the dollars to fund this, but we're not getting kids. We've got 10% of the kids in the Portland Public Schools out of the classroom on a chronic basis. So we're trying to look for some tools to try to get bang for our buck. So if it was a funded mandate, would you be more open to the idea?
Senator George, I would say to you that I suspect I would be less opposed, but really my fundamental reasons for being opposed have to do with the mandate component of it and also the issues of appeal. It's not so much the payment for appeal. The resource that is costly, if you would, is time in terms of how all of those pieces work. Because, you know, folks, if they're going to appeal, are going to have to bring in evidence. We're going to have to cross-check the evidence. It's no different, quite frankly, than the appeals process that we currently have to go through for expulsions. And for those reasons, I think I would still be opposed to it as mandated legislation as opposed to enabling legislation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, then I'd want to move on to our students.
Just one more question.
Oh, yes, sir.
We have the information from the Portland Public Schools, 10%. Do you have any idea what the number would be for the North Clackamas School District?
I don't. If the presumption is, and I don't have any specific data, but if the presumption is that the youngsters that would essentially be eligible for this would be youngsters who have dropped out of school. Our dropout rates in this school district as a whole are under 4%. That would be the number. I'm trying to translate that real quickly for you. 4% of roughly 6,000, we might be talking about 180 to 200 students.
Thank you.
That's just a rough approximation.
Appreciate your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Janet Atkins has a question, then we'll move on.
Okay.
I was just going to respond, Senator, to Senator Starr. I think the Portland numbers included, they might not necessarily be dropouts, but they might have moved, and the school district doesn't know that. So they would be required to notify on those students and then find out if the student was someplace else. So I don't think it's necessarily the people that would end up being suspended or that are necessarily dropouts. It was just the number of people that they don't have documentation for it and they're gone that long. So
that would miss 15.
That's where this gets very complex.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Okay, we're going to hear from, let's ask Thomas George and Ben Price to come forward. Point out for the record, I believe there's no relation to Senator Larry George.
No, sir.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that people know this. We're not stacking the deck here. Welcome.
My name is Thomas George. I'm from Corvallis. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 397. Basically, the one thing that I wanted to say in response to the superintendent was that we provide school districts with the ability to notify the Department of Motor Vehicles with the thought that they will do so. We don't just go ahead and say that they can do something and then expect it to never happen. He spoke a lot about straining resources, and I understand that because everybody has something to say about how the school districts are underfunded. And, teachers don't get paid enough. There's not enough funding for schools, period. Funding the bill would be an excellent idea, in my opinion, especially if it makes it more acceptable to the school districts themselves. But the bottom line is that paying the taxes that help support the schools, strain everyone else's resources as well. And if we're not getting a return on the investment in the education of the children of Oregon, then we have to do something about that. That's not something we can just allow to happen. It was also mentioned that there already is mandatory reporting of dropouts and children that move to the state school board that has to be passed along already. My question is, why can't you, with the same form, just say photocopy it, send it to the Department of Motor Vehicles? I agree that the appeals process for this would also take up some time, but the superintendent also said that there's an identical process underway for expulsions as well. They already have the means set up to do any kind of appeals process they need to do. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. And it was excellent testimony, and your reasoning was excellent. Thank you very much. We may have some questions. Let's go to Ben, our honorary page for the day. Please state your name for the record. And
Benjamin Price. Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and committee. I am here in favor of passing the bill, and the reason for this is from personal experience. Last year, I attended LeGrand High School, and I had some attendance issues. I started skipping school, and I guess I felt like I just didn't care anymore. And after a while, when I would go back to school after missing a certain number of days, it was hard for me to catch up, and I would feel lost, and that would make me discouraged. And at that point, I would just feel like I would miss more school. And it started this cycle that eventually led me to feel like I wanted to drop out. And in my mind, I felt like that's what I was going to do. And I felt like I lost direction, didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And fortunately, I was given the opportunity to move to Milwaukee this past summer. And I actually live really close to the school, and I was able to enroll. And something I've learned since I've been here is how important an education is. And we are privileged as students because we have so many resources here, whether we realize it or not. And I think the biggest thing we can do to make sure we do good in school is attendance. Being here every day really makes all the difference. And at this point, if you're here every day and you don't understand the lessons, you don't know what's going on in the class, then you can ask your teacher and you can use the resources around you. There's great resources. And if you're still not doing good at that point, then I would say it's probably the teacher's fault. But, I mean, we truly have resources here. And if I would have not had a license and if I would have not had a car last year, I think I would have attended more. And I think a big number of kids who are skipping school consecutively have their license and they use their car to go skip school. And I really think that if they had their license suspended, it's a privilege, it's not a right. If they had that privilege suspended temporarily, they would realize, you know, maybe I should go back to school, and because it's no fun not having a license. So just from personal experience, I know that if I would have had my license suspended, I would have been back in school. I wouldn't have wanted to lose my license. And I think it will help students realize just how important education is. And so that's where I'm coming from on the issue.
Thanks, Mr. Price. I'm just curious, based on your experience last year and your experience this year, how do you feel about school now in terms of its meaning to you, and What has been the altering factor or change factor from you from this year from last year?
I would say, I mean, I still have my mornings where, you know, it's hard to get out of bed. You know,
we adult.
Yeah. I mean, you debate whether you want to come to school, but just getting myself here every day, no matter what, waking up and coming to school and being here from day one and not missing anything, that's been the biggest factor, attendance. And since I've been here at school this year, I've realized just how privileged we are. Now, although we're legally required to come to school, it's a big privilege to be here and receive an education. And we have all the resources we need, and it's just a matter of how hard we try. It's the will. And that's something that I thought I lost last year and that I've gained this year since I've come back to school. And so I would say attendance is the biggest issue.
Well, I commend you for that and for what that will do for you in the future. Questions for either of these two? Thank you very much. Alex Walsh and Jeff Brackett. Either one of you, it just starts off, give us your name, and get going.
Hello, Chairperson and his committee. I am Jeff Brackett. Throughout on the paper I put neutral, but now I'd like to state that I am against. What I got from the discussion earlier was that if you were appealing, that you still would have a revoked license. And a number of things occurred to me. If the person is having a job, and after a school job, that they need to go to in order to get money for things that they have to pay for, such as phone bills or different things like that, or rent, because I know some of my friends that didn't go to any other alternative schools, but they are being very successful in the job that they have now. And without a car, they would not be able to access any of the opportunities given from their job. Another thing that I'd like to touch on is that with this, it makes me feel like the school board would be using fear to make me go to school. I really don't think that fear should be a factor into making someone want to go to school. I feel like it should be a personal choice, wanting to excel in their life without being forced to. Because if I was forced to go to school, by taking away my license, then I'd feel covered and enveloped in this thing that I wouldn't want anything to be a part of. I think that instead of using fear, making people want to go to school in different ways by making this is an entirely different topic, but making things more fun, not fun but challenging at the same time. But that's something else. But basically, I'd feel like I'm being controlled by being afraid. So I really don't think this would help the students in the North Clackamas School District or any other district. I also think that if students were to be forced to go to school, that they would end up not even wanting to. So I'm just restating that.
Thank you, Mr. Brackett. Mr. Walsh.
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson and Committee. My name is Alex Walsh. I am from Grants Pass area, so I know about the tornadoes. I was originally had no information on this bill. Now I'm opposed to this bill. I just don't think that it is really the school's responsibility to be enforcing this kind of almost judgment on the kids when about their license. You can drop out when you're 16, so there's really no reason for this. And the effort that it would take to enforce this would be too much, and there's not enough funding anyway.
Thank you. Questions for you, these gentlemen. Questions. Senator Starr.
The question I have is, if this bill were to be passed into law, do you think that kids would drive anyway, basically without a driver's license, and drive basically illegally without a driver's license? Do you think that it would keep kids from driving?
That would be against the law.
That wasn't his question.
Yes. Kids will break the law for this. The kids already break the law for the passenger law enough that this isn't going to do anything.
I guess you have raised another issue. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I guess my question to you is that we're putting an immense amount of resources in the schools right now. The state of Oregon, I saw a report, all funds is approaching $10,000 per student per year, which means in a class of 30 kids, $300,000 is being spent on those 30 kids. According to the report we have from staff, 10% of students in the Portland Public Schools would be eligible for this particular piece of legislation, which means that we're talking about a class of 30 kids, $30,000 of our dollars that we're all spending to educate those kids are being spent on kids who are chronic absentees. And so I guess give us some other feedback. This is one idea that a parent had from Philomath that they saw their kid being in a tough situation. Give me some other ideas about how we take this 10% of public school kids that are chronically absent. How do we get them more engaged? I mean, you say more fun, but school's not really fun. It never was for me, and I hated every day of it, to be perfectly honest with you. But how do we make it so, because there has to be a certain amount of penalty in society if you don't take advantage of what the public is doing in resources. And I guess my question to you is that there has to be some kind of punishment for kids that are, in essence, wasting public resources. These are resources that could be spent on other kids. They're just not filling their seat. We're spending the money, but we're not educating them. If you could give me some insight, that would really help out.
My opinion is that their punishment for not getting education is when they get in the real world. I mean, they're not going to make any money.
And one of the things that I'm confused on, the 10%, all of them drive, correct? Or the ones that it pertains to?
No, it's just 10. Not necessarily, no. It's just they would have absences, but it wouldn't necessarily mean if they were driving or not.
So do you know the percentage of the students that do drive that it would ultimately pertain to?
All right, now we're supposed to ask you the question. You know, that's a very good question. Don't have the answer to that, but I think that's something we would want to find out. On average, I mean, primarily we're talking juniors and seniors who are eligible for driving privileges as to how many actually number consists of. And even whether this 10% involves juniors and seniors or the entire student body, half of which wouldn't be eligible for it anyway.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, if 10% is the average of the student population, 10% of juniors and seniors, so whatever the population of juniors and seniors are, we're still talking about juniors and seniors that are 10% of those are eligible for the suspension of the criteria. I guess my frustration is that every year education for a student gets to be more money. And we're just spending more and more dollars, and yet we seem to have this increased absenteeism, this increase where, and then what happens is these kids get out, they don't make the money, they don't have, and then they turn around and they come and they say, well, we went on the Oregon Health Plan, or they ask for other public services because they don't have the skills to be able to cope in the real world. So, I mean, there's ramifications here that go beyond the 2 years that they're a junior and senior, and I'm just trying to figure out, look, the number one indicator of whether or not they're going to be back on public services or is whether or not they have an education. That's the number one indicator. So if we can get these kids educated, when they get into the real world, they're not going to be coming back asking us to get on the Oregon Health Plan, get on the Oregon Trail Card, and these other things that are also costing the resources, that are drawing resources away from the school. So I guess I'm brainstorming here. I'm looking for some answers on what you guys think we could do to try to make sure that this percentage of kids are not being absent. So I'm just looking for some ideas.
Thinking of those, you know. I think we'll move on to a couple more students here. Thank you very much, Jeff and Alex. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Ryan McLaughlin and Randall McCorkle. Hey, guys. We would like to start.
Hello there, Mr. Chairperson and Committee. My name is Ryan McLaughlin. I come up here very much for this bill. Mr. Naso said that complicated issues have simple solutions, and I think the simple solution would be keeping kids in school, no matter what that is. I find that, if anything, this bill is lacking in that it keeps kids who don't have licenses, it pulls them out of the getting treated poorly or losing that incentive. I'd almost feel that perhaps not allowing them to get their license in the first place if they go to get it and have these absences would be a good thing. Most kids don't know how important this is. A lot of them, this is even their education, as high school is it. And if you're going to college, it's what you build everything off of. So have to do whatever you can to keep them here and teach them what they need to know. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Randall McCorkle, and I'm for this. I believe that driving is a privilege, and if you abuse a privilege, you should no longer have that privilege. And that's pretty much what I got to say.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen, both of you, very much. Katie Polanski and Justin Birmingham.
Hello, Mr. Chair and Subcommittee. Can I first take the time? I'm a senior here at Milwaukee High School, and my name is Katie Polanski. Thank you so much for being here and letting us be a part of this.
My name is Justin Birmingham, Senator Metzger and the committee. I would like to echo Katie's remarks. Welcome, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to work with you today.
I have actually been back and forth in my mind on this bill. It is a complex issue, and so there are both negative and positive aspects, but I believe the positive sides outweigh the negative sides, because I think for these students that are perpetual absentees and don't come to school, I think we do have to at least make the effort to have an effect on them to make a change and give incentive to come to school. And also, I have noticed that the students that do have licenses and that do drive to school are more likely to skip school once they come. I see kids coming, dropping off their friends and then leaving in their cars first period because I walk to school and I see what happens outside. I perceive school as an opportunity and a privilege, but I know a lot of other of my peers see it as a chore and something that they're forced to do. But I don't know if they realize right now, if they don't take advantage of this in real life is going to be a reality check, I guess that's why it's called real life. And I think if we revoke their licenses, it gives them a glimpse of what they have to look forward to if they don't complete high school.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairperson and committee, Justin Birmingham, once again, thank you. As it is currently written, from how I interpret it, I am opposed to Senate Bill 397 only because, as Senator George in his questions to Mr. Naso was asking, the fact that it's an unfunded mandate is concerning to me. I'm only one individual in my small room of class of room 111, and so I'm not entirely privy to the responsibilities of our administrative and classified staff who support them. But I do know in general that that crew in our building and throughout the high schools and across the state are overstretched at the moment. And asking them to make these additional responsibilities part of their everyday work duties without giving them the resources to support that, I think is perhaps unfair. The classified personnel, for whom I'm not a spokesperson necessarily, but just advocating for today, I think would appreciate the support required to help them. So, in general, I'm in favor of the concept of retaining students, and as Senator George says, all the ramifications that go with student dropouts and the taxing on our limited state resources. But I think the investment required, whatever that figure would be, to help, I can name Kim Owens, Lisa Ryder, and friends down there to shore up any potential gaps would be a worthwhile investment.
Thank you very much. Is this your class?
Many of these students are mine, yes.
Great. Well, thank you, and thank you for having them attend today. Questions for any of these? Thank you very much. Okay, our last two that have signed up on this bill is Tegan McCarthy and Kelly Carlisle. Is Tegan here? Did I say it wrong? The wrong name? Is there a McCarthy here that I said the wrong first name wrong?
Apparently she didn't sign up for it, but she's a great speaker.
Why don't you come up here and tell us what you think? You have a friend in the audience that signed you up. Volunteerism is always admired. While you're thinking about it, we'll have Mr. Carlisle speak. Welcome. Thank your name.
Thank you, Senator Metzger and committee. We are grateful that you're here, and thank you for choosing an issue that brings forth sincere opinions on both sides of the matter. I would like to
just say your name for the record. For
thank you. My name is Kelly Carlisle, principal at Milwaukee High School, and I reside in Clackamas County. I would like to echo some of the words of our superintendent and perhaps give a little bit more specific detail as to why I am opposed to Senate Bill 397. I'll start by answering one of the questions that was asked, I believe, by Senator George about the parental notification from our building. We have several redundancies, actually, in our system that are intended to get the message across to parents in as many ways as possible. We have an auto dialer, another issue that I think is coming up today. We have an auto dialer in our school. And, you know, I will say that there are probably some students who are pretty savvy and know how to intercept those calls, but we do make the attempt to notify parents every evening when their students have been missing from school. We also have, as Superintendent Naso mentioned, parental access to student information available on the web, and that's a new development that is just currently being rolled out, and we're hopeful that that will be a really important strength in our school system's opportunities to connect with parents. We also have daily and weekly progress checks, which are oftentimes chosen by parents, students and teachers when attendance gets to the place where it's a real concern. There's been a conference. Let's use this as a way of monitoring how the student is doing coming to school. And our attendance office also sends out a 5-day absence notification. That's not mandated by anything, but we do that just to let parents know that we've seen a 5-day pattern of absenteeism. We're concerned that we're headed to the 10 days. And as you know, after 10 days, we need to drop the student from our rolls. I'm concerned about what happens to our students who have a high degree of mobility due to circumstances that are not necessarily the ones that they own. But when they move from one school to the next, and there's a period of transition, sometimes their data falls through the cracks or something happens that I think we need to be very concerned about whether we would be inaccurately reporting their attendance or lack thereof. I'd also like to mention that I don't believe that the primary reason for dropping out of school is about attendance. I believe it's out of credit deficiency. Certainly a contributing factor to credit deficiency is attendance. But I would want to be careful to say there are way too many reasons for dropping out of school for us to capture it all into one set of data around attendance. And for that reason, I'm opposed to this measure. I would like to mention that in this very room, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights, you will see approximately 40 to 50 dropouts coming back to school. We call it e-school. It's an evening alternative school, and it is designed to bring kids back so that they can either finish a diploma or get the education necessary to successfully complete their testing for a GED. We believe that bringing them back into school is the answer. And for many of these kids, the driver's license that they have is one of their few assets that they get to exercise to get themselves to the evening school and from the evening school to work. Many of these students do not live with their parents any longer, and there are so many different circumstances that I just think that's going to be another dimension that works against them rather than for them. I recognize that there can be an appeals process, but I also have concerns about that. I'm wondering if the appeals process is managed by the DMV, which focuses not on students, but on driving and on transportation. How in the world are they going to consistently manage across the state the appeals process so that the fairness for kids in Hillsborough is evenly weighted with kids in LeGrand and kids in Klamath Falls? Are these handled by the same committee that travels around and listens to each case? And if it's unfunded, I'm concerned that we're putting another layer of burden on our state agency. Certainly that would be the case in our building. And we simply don't have the bandwidth to do this sort of project without dropping something else that we would find more important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin. Well, Tegan, you've had a chance to think a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you think? And tell us your name.
My name is Tegan McCarthy.
Very good.
Thank you. I'd like to say that I am in favor of this bill because of personal experience. I have had my license since I was 16. I'm now 18. However, I do not have a car. There have been many occasions when my mother has let me drive her car to school, like when she has gone on vacation and I need it to get to school. And when it was here and I'm sitting in my first period class and I know it's right outside park, I am tempted to go at lunch and go get my lunch, and then I'll be tempted to stay longer wherever I want to go. And I feel that it's enabling students to get these unexcused absences. And
great, you did a great job. Any questions?
Yes,
Senator Montana.
Thank you. I appreciate all of your testimony. It sort of has given me a new perspective. I have 11 nieces and nephews, and four of them, two boys and two gals, dropped out of high school. They just couldn't cope, and all of them were fairly unique. One, they had parents that were just, they didn't have jobs, so they would stay up late. There was no discipline in the home to even encourage the students, so there was no parental guidance in one case. Another was just a very slow learner, very slow learner. But finally, we got him into a GED, and he is now making actually more money than a state legislator.
That's not saying much.
That's true. And then the other just got into drugs, and it was a total disaster. So I think each student is so unique on why they don't go to school. And I think that this bill would help some students, but it may hurt other students, and it may not make any difference to other students. So I'm still in a quandary about this bill. But do you see the same thing with the various students that have dropped out? I guess that's the question. Or you know the reasons why they've dropped out.
I suppose my response to that is I think school...
Or they skip school.
Certainly. And I think school officials, particularly teachers, counselors, administrators, know the students well. They have that relationship with them, and they know the circumstances. And for that reason, the option to inform DMV certainly makes a lot more sense than the mandate to do so, and then trusting that the DMV will hear each set of circumstances to the length of detail that has been established over time with our school staff. So I think in long answer to your short question, I believe that the reasons for dropping out are too myriad to just answer with taking away a license.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Carl. I appreciate your testimony. You know, as a father of young kids, thank God they're not driving. I don't know what I'm going to do when they do. you know, we take away, as parents, privileges from our, in fact, just this morning I had to discipline my daughter. And we do that by, you know, taking privileges away. The interaction between the school and the parent, it seems like the opportunity to, whether through counseling or through the administrator, contacting the parent in those conversations, the parent has, I would assume, the authority to take the keys away. I would hope the authority to take the keys away without having government, you know, go to the DMV or go to the process that's laid out in this bill. Talk a little bit about how the district works with parents in that conversation about getting kids so that they do get to school, so that we do provide an education to a child and hopefully move that child down the line.
Thank you. I would say that it is our intent to try every angle that we can to bring parents in to be part of a conversation when attendance becomes a significant issue. Obviously, when we're talking about a school of this size, we're starting to look for kids with the most significant patterns of non-attendance. And so the occasional student who chooses to skip a class may be able to do so without a whole lot of intervention from school staff, but certainly we're doing our best to capture that information in ways that can still make it to the parents if possible. When we see the larger issues start to surface, we understand that there could be some really important opportunities for us to intervene. We need to do that in a partnership with the parents, and so to get around the same table with the student, the parents, counselor, whoever else needs to be in that room, to really get at what the underlying issues are for non-attendance, we find that to be the most effective way that we have is together to team on this. It feels like by just notifying DMV about the non-attendance, that would be a dynamic that is taken out of the hands of the parents to decide whether that's in the best interest of their particular circumstances or not.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. What we'll do here, we'll complete our testimony on that, and the committee will gnaw on this a little bit and consider for bringing it back later for a work session. But we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 397. On this bill, I want to thank everybody who's testified. This has been very, very helpful, and the committee will consider that testimony moving forward. We're going to actually try to move a bill this morning before lunch. We'll see what we can do with that. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2274. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2274 is at the request of the Department of Transportation and would eliminate the sunset on current law that doubles fines for traffic offenses that are committed in safety corridors. The effect would be December 31st, 2007. Mr. Chair, the current statute for authorizing the doubling of fines in safety corridors is set to sunset, which means the statute would go away. On January 1st, 2008, it was considered a pilot at the time it was introduced. And with the experience under the program, the Department of Transportation is ready to request the taking off of the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Troy Costales for the first time this session. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Yes, it's first time with you during this session. Appreciate the opportunity to be here at high school and to talk about safety corridors, which there are a few close to our location. House Bill 2274, as Ms. Askin pointed out, is to remove the sunset provision of the current ability for the department to identify corridors that can post the ability to do double fines for law enforcement and for the courts. The safety corridor program was established by the department years ago, and we've had anywhere from 4 or 5 locations in the state up to as many as 13 or 14 locations in the state identified as safety corridors. One of the handouts that you have is a map of the current corridors as well as a list of where they are. We do have a large size map here to the side, too, for those that are interested in seeing where the corridors are. The request came from the 1999 legislature in order to allow the department to identify 2 very specific corridors for double fine. Oregon 18 near the Grand Ronde area, and then also nearby U.S. 26 Sandy to Mount Hood. The 2001 legislature extended the pilot project out through the end of the year of 2003, And then in turn, the 2003 legislature, based on the positive reactions and the things going on very well in those corridors, extended the sunset after 2008 and also allowed the department to put the double fine signs on other corridors. The reason for the discretion request in this bill is that the department will not put up double fine signs on corridors that are on their way to being decommissioned. They're no longer a safety corridor. In your map, you've seen, and in the list, there are five corridors that were identified, program was put in place, and they've actually come off the safety corridor list because things have improved. Would like to say that actually on all the other segments, from when they were initially identified as safety corridor, in every single case, the crash, injury, and fatal information on those corridors have also gotten better. So the program at the bottom line works. When we did a research study with the general public in relationship to the double fine piece, which was originally requested in the 99-2001 session, the general public understood that there was a higher risk when in that particular corridor around speeding, that they, in some cases, were very much aware of where the safety corridor was, in part this depended on where they lived. Some areas of the state didn't know what the corridor was, just in part because they didn't happen to have traveled through some of the ones because they didn't live in that area. The other part also is that there is signing, and it is very clear and identified on all the major entries through the corridor where the double fine is going to be a potential provision. We don't want to catch anybody by surprise. That the double fine court signs are very prevalent, and also at the beginning of the corridor as well. When we've looked at the individual safety corridors, there are two things just to, if you are interested. We do have published safety corridor program guidelines. The program is all about the four E's. There's engineering work, there's education work, there's enforcement work, and there's emergency medical work. And all of those have to come together. They all have to be present. There is a local community involvement. If those things all aren't there, corridor program's not going to work. And the double fine is just one small sliver of the big pie, but it elevates the issue for those traveling through there that we're serious about the fact that this is an area that you need to pay attention to be careful because of past history, that this road is worse than other roads of its type and of its style. We also do every year, and didn't want to give you a big billfolder to walk home with, but this is a very detailed analysis of every one of the corridors and breaking it up into segments, identifying where we may need to do further engineering work or where do we want to, when we talk to our partners in law enforcement, where would they concentrate because this is a particular area of interest where there are crashes. As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, Safety Corridor Program works. It's been around for a little more than a decade. We've had five very successful decommissionings. And there are a couple others that are under consideration because they are now below average compared to other roads of their type. The volume of safety corridors is up to the department, and if you were to point any finger anywhere, basically you're probably looking at me making the decision. I'm not comfortable with more than 12 or 13 around the state just because the issue is these are the high-profile places. We always run the struggle and the battle of do we light one corridor up? Well, part of it is which of the corridors don't we have there because don't want to dilute the presence and dilute the importance of what the corridors are. And one last comment, Mr. Chair. Cities and counties can choose to adopt these guidelines if they wanted to do something on a city street or a county road. In a couple cases, they have done that. The program we're talking about here in this bill and the double fine provision is solely on the state highway system for the roads controlled by ODOT. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions and also interested in the testimony from the students here today and what they think about the safety corridor program.
Yeah, well, thank you, Troy. A good big thank you to the department for the work on this area. I think it has been a tremendously successful program. We have a couple in my district and Modest Anderson's district, and one of the ones that was just decommissioned, is the one between Sandy and Gresham that abuts our district because it worked, and we're able to decommission and save lives and got the message out. So I really, really appreciate that. It has been very successful. Senator George.
Real quick, and you want to get moving, Mr. Chair. Troy, you were talking just at the end of your testimony, which was ringing through my head the entire time, which is you get too many of them, and the double fine becomes the fine. How is the department making sure that you don't overutilize this tool and take away its effectiveness by overusing it? Just real quickly, if you could explain it to me, I really appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman and Senator George, thank you. In part, what we're looking at first is this a corridor that, out of the small set we're talking about, is this one that elevates up? Is it, worst of this particular bunch? Is there law enforcement that is engaged and understand what the double fine provision is? Is their judiciary engaged and understand what the double fine is? Because the people that implement it, if they're not involved and know what's going on, we put the double fine provision up and then turn around and you drive through it. First time something, you get a citation and it doesn't happen, how are you going to behave in the corridor next time? So we want to make sure that the system is in place to handle the fact that the double fines are there. Also, is it a particular corridor that needs attention because it's worst of the worst? When you put the double fine in, this is not an easy decision because you're affecting a lot of people. The day the sign goes up is when the courts have to know, when you have to make sure the tickets are dated the right way because now the double fine piece comes in there. It's not something that we're necessarily going to apply to all corridors because there are those that are getting better. And if they're slated to decommission, it's a lot of work to ramp up to post it, to turn around, and 6 months later, the signs come down on the corridor itself because it's gotten better. So we're not going to use the double fine provision in that particular case because it's we would be putting too much emphasis on that when it's actually getting better, and we want to try and neutralize the situation a little bit.
Real quick follow-up. I guess, Troy, is there a number? Is there a magic number statewide that you guys have, like you said, 12 or 13, and that's it? You're trying to keep around that number?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, no, there isn't. It's pretty much up to the discretion of the department, but we work with the road authorities and law enforcement in the community, and we're not going to put something that's a surprise because it takes a community effort to do the safe deployment program. There is no set number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. This class ends when? A few minutes, right?
5 minutes.
Okay. Okay, let's see. I think we have pretty much the same, don't we?
Josh Hamilton?
Josh, why don't you come forward? You haven't testified. Let's get a comment from you, and then we're going to see if we can move this bill for you.
Good morning, Chairman.
Yeah. State your name, please.
Josh Hamilton.
Okay.
Now, I'll be completely honest with this, and I'm pretty naive to this situation. But safety corridors are called safety corridors for a reason, to ensure safety. And so raising a fine, in my opinion, if that's necessary, then it should happen. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you, Josh. Any questions for Josh? Thank you very much. I'm going to go get an outfit like that as soon as now I know what cool looks like. I'm going to be there. No. All right, let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2274. Open the work session on House Bill 2274.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'd move House Bill 2274 to the Senate floor with the D-Pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2274 to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? Let's go ahead and take the roll. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator
Starr?
Aye.
Chair Metzger? Aye. House Bill 2274, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. I'll carry that bill. And for our guests, we're the guests, for our host today, this bill has passed the House of Representatives, now has passed the Senate committee. We will be sending this to the Senate floor. And if it passes on the Senate floor, it will then become law. So if you participated in passing the law here in your presence, and we really appreciate the testimony that you have given on these issues. I know we have another class this afternoon. If you're free, come and join that. We'll be talking about another issue. I'll do that later. We'll be in recess till 12:15, and we'll have lunch with you. in. We really appreciate you hosting us here today. And we had a couple of bills in the morning session with other classes, one of which we passed out to the Senate floor. I'm Rick Besker. I'm the chairman of the committee. I represent Senate District 26, which is all of East Clackamas County, essentially from Clackamas Town Center East, and all of Hood River County and East Multnomah County at the Gresham border line. And I'll start with my right and let my colleagues introduce themselves.
I'm State Senator Larry George. I represent Senate District 13. I live in Sherwood. My district reaches from Forest Grove, Sherwood, Wilsonville, Newburgh, St. Paul, and Kaiser.
And I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I represent District 15. I live in Hillsborough, and I represent the communities in Western Washington County of Hillsborough, Forest Grove, Corneas, and North Plains.
Hi. I'm one of the few women in the state legislature, although we're up to a third of the legislature is now women. But I am State Senator Lori Montes-Anderson. I represent Gresham, Wood Village, Fairview, and Troutdale. I'm a nurse by trade. I was a nurse most of my professional life, and now I'm a state senator. And believe me, health care is on everyone's horizon, but I love being on this Transportation and Economic Development Committee. I also served on the Gresham Barlow School Board for just about 10 years, and I was also a clinic nurse in the school-based health center at Oregon City High School. So high school students are very near and dear to my heart.
And our committee administrator, Janet Atkins.
Thank you. I'm Janet Atkins. I'm the staff for the committee, along with Adam Hicks, who's running the computer and the sound system and the recording system. And when we get back to Salem, the sound will be, the recording will be downloaded so that it's available on the internet through the legislature's web page. You can do several clicks and you can listen to the testimony. Probably not by tomorrow, but the day after will be on web audio, and you could listen to the meeting if you want to. You can hear your friends that came in the morning or hear yourselves this afternoon. And Adam's from Hills from the Detroit area, went to school in Salem at Corbin College, and I grew up in Medford, went to the University of Oregon, and lived in Salem since about 1987 or 79. Thanks.
Thank you, Janet. Well, thank you again for hosting us, and I think we'll have an interesting discussion this afternoon. With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 863 and SJR 33. And I'm the co-sponsor of both these pieces of legislation. So Janet will give us the committee introduction. I'll make some opening comments, and then we're going to lead off with an attorney from the Department of Justice and into our student comments and others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 863 first is a statutory change that would prohibit callers from using automatic dialing and announcing devices to call either a telephone or a cellular phone unless the phone customer has requested or previously authorized the call. There are exceptions in the bill for callers that have an established business relationship, maybe to let you know about a credit card change or something, with a customer, or callers that are attempting to collect a debt, or callers that are in enforcement officials from emergency law enforcement, perhaps. And it also exempts callers from school districts. So school districts would be able to use automatic dialing and announcing devices to let your parents know that you weren't in school that day. There's a number of other requirements that you can read in the bill about if you are making automatic dialing and announcing device calls. You have to disconnect within 10 seconds, and you have to block any calls that you do make so that you are not calling fire numbers, law enforcement numbers, emergency numbers, healthcare officials, or cellular numbers for which the customer is charged for each call. because of constitutional questions about free speech, in order for Senate Bill 863 to take effect and not be challenged under Oregon's Constitution and Free Speech Clause, Senate Joint Resolution 33 would refer to voters at the next primary election an amendment to the Oregon Constitution, giving the Legislative Assembly or voters through the initiative process the authority to enact laws that regulate phone calls made to residents by means of automated devices. So depending on the vote on Senate Joint Resolution 33, if it does get referred to voters, Senate Bill 863 could take effect if it was passed by the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. I'll make some introductory comments, and then I'm going to ask my staff for the benefit of those in the audience, because we're very familiar with what we mean by automated calls, and get a sample of that, and then we'll go into our discussion. Primarily, Representative Schaffer and I introduced 863 and Senate Joint Resolution 33, because for those of you who are familiar with those messages on your phone, they're very popular. To populate your phones, especially during election seasons. Certainly, Senate Bill 863 applies to all manners of automated phone conversation. But the thing that we hear probably most often from folks is the political season, when they can become very, very commonplace. And I think it's fair to say that most people are pretty irritated about it, because it basically takes control of their own household communication from them. It was interesting. I mentioned this to Senator Starr. In October, I was in Bismarck, North Dakota on business, and I was speaking to a state senator there, and he had told me they had just passed this bill a year ago in North Dakota. Keeping in mind, their constitution is a little different than ours, but, of course, all of our bills and laws have to conform to the U.S. Constitution, and there's always questions about that. And I asked him if that had been they were worried because of it being challenged on constitutional basis of free speech. And it was very interesting. This guy was telling me, he said, well, you know, we don't care. He says, 95% of the people in North Dakota hate them. And so we said, let them sue us. And we just passed the bill. And so as I was researching this, I found a number of states, I think a half a dozen now, have passed legislation similar to this, three of which this session, and three others are moving through this process to try and put some regulation on the automated phone device. I was kidding with my colleagues on this, that I've received a lot of pushback on this against this bill from inside where we work, the state capitol. And what everybody who was against it that I heard from had one thing in common, and that is they were involved with politics, because they use the political calls, but certainly receiving a lot of support from everyday citizens who have to be the recipient of that. So this will be a very interesting discussion as to the weighing the difference between privacy, the right privacy in your own home and who can access free speech versus rights to make you listen to that speech, and the idea of the free speech issues, and just where is that barrier? Where is the difference between your rights to privacy and your right for someone to be able to try and speak with you? With that, I think what I'm going to ask to do is Ryan Tribbetis from my office. We actually had a hard time finding some automated calls because when word got around the Capitol, people really didn't want to provide them. But I happen to have a couple myself, and we found a few other ones. And this will give you a sampling of what they are. And I think the first one we're going to play is to give you an example of how they're used. The first one, it was an opponent of mine this last election cycle who used it, I believe, to advertise a town hall. So this was for name identification and to, I would say, a positive use of an automated call to invite people to participate. And that's one way people use these calls.
So that is to involve people.
Sorry. Go ahead. Now, that is similar to, obviously, that's for political purposes and to get, name ID, and we use that in our professions. It's also similar to what the school would use for other purposes, but the same idea is to inform about you being absent from school, or if you're in a rural area, like where I live, our local fire department will send those out to say it's a burning day or a non-burning day. That's one way automated phone calls are used. The next one is strictly the one that we probably hear most often is, the political call that's for or against candidates or issues that start dominating, usually for a primary or general election. Sometimes can be lots of them, depending on how active the political climate is where you live.
Hello, this is an important
this is an important message from National Right to Life asking you to vote for George W. Bush for president and to vote no on Proposition 1. Al Gore would allow partial birth abortion to continue. Al Gore supports using your tax dollars to pay for abortion. George Bush opposes partial birth abortion and will work to end it. George Bush opposes using your tax dollars to pay for abortion. Proposition 1 would allow physicians to help kill patients by assisted suicide, a form of euthanasia. Please vote for life on Tuesday. Vote for George W. Bush for president and vote no on Proposition 1. Thank you.
And then the last two, these are ones that we will, I think all of us will get a lot, especially during general elections. And because of the cost of these automated calls continues to go down, they become a very important tool in the political process. The last two we have is actually in a state election, for and against. This one I actually had a lot of fun with, because if you'll notice, the person, the voice on doing this call, one is for and one's against, and it's the same person doing both.
Friends and neighbors, this is your former state representative, Judy Smith. I'm calling with an important message about Jim Gilbert, candidate for state representative. You've probably heard about the increase in water and sewer rates. Jim Gilbert helped found a group that recently sued our city to vote on a water plan that was approved by DEQ, PA, and Clackamas County. But Jim's group thought they knew better and pursued this suit and an additional lawsuit that together have so far cost our city $600,000 in attorney's fees and construction delays. The city of Malala is being forced to raise our sewer and water rates. Vote for Max Sumner for state representative. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Don't fall for last-minute campaign attacks.
Vote for Jim Gilbert for state representative. Thank you for your time.
Okay. So we thought that was rather interesting. But that gives you a flavor, I think. Just to give you a show of hands, how many people, when you go home, because you probably dominate the phone more than your parents, are familiar with going home and having automated calls on your home phone machines at different times? So it's pretty common. So we have, now that we have a kind of a set on that, one final thing on it before we ask our testimony to begin. And as Janet pointed out, SGR 33 is a constitutional amendment. It doesn't actually enact any law. What it does is, if it were to pass and go to the voters, you would have to approve it. And what it would do is simply allow the legislature, or through initiative, to regulate automated calls. 863 actually has very specific ways in which to regulate them. Now, potentially, Senate Joint Resolution 33 could pass and not pass 863. In other words, give the legislature the right to set regulation, but not at that time. But maybe they don't like the type of regulation in 863. They just want to have that option at a future date. 863 could pass without SJR 33, and while we've written it to be as constitutional as possible, it could be challenged because Oregon's Constitution is much more lenient than the federal Constitution. And so it is recommended by counsel that we amend the Constitution to try and thwart any attempt to challenge on a constitutional basis. So that just gives you a little bit why we have two bills for that. And 863, the implementing language, doesn't actually say you can't use automated calls, but what it does, it sets out certain requirements that you have to do, and you can still continue to use them if you have the permission. If you have an organization, people can check off, I'm willing to take calls. And it does exempt things like schools and fire and other emergency services and allows them to use that. With that, we'll begin testimony on these bills, and I'll ask that Andrew Scholl from the Oregon Department of Justice to come forward.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I am an Assistant Attorney General with that section. The Oregon Department of Justice, as you may be aware, has long supported Oregonians' rights to choose not to receive certain telephone calls. The support has been for both consumer protection and privacy reasons. The department, therefore, supports the general concept behind Senate Bill 863. Not only can Oregonians choose to receive calls otherwise prohibited by Senate Bill 863 through consent or business relationships, But the prohibitions also won't become law unless a necessary constitutional amendment is approved by Oregonians, is chosen by Oregonians. With that being said, just as with the current automatic dialing and announcing device statute, previously found to be unconstitutional by the Oregon courts, but still on the market, still on the Oregon revised statute books, it's ORS 759-290. The department also feels the appropriate place for the Attorney General's enforcement authority under Senate Bill 863 is in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The current statute, as I said, ORS 759-290, had enforcement authority through ORS 646-608. This was a provision within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. This, of course, was prior to the finding that ORS 759-290 was unconstitutional. So the statute's still on the books. It's still associated with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, provision 646-608. In fact, Senate Bill 863 would repeal that 608 provision to clean up the statute. We suggest this, we would ask this, because the Unlawful Trade Practices Act provides for investigation and settlement authority, both of which often help the department and alleged violators avoid litigation in Oregon courts. Senate Bill 863's enforcement provision is essentially set up to force litigation in Oregon courts. It for lack of a better term, it's a sue first, ask questions later enforcement mechanism. So anyway, with that being said, the department supports the concept behind 863. We just feel that some suggestions and some change in the text should be considered. With that, I can definitely attempt to answer any questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Scholl. I guess my first question is, in your own research with the Department of Justice, have you had conversations with other states on some of the similar legislation at all, and any particular direction on that you think the committee would find valuable?
We have had general discussions. They generally tended to revolve around Oregon's pursuit of an automatic dialing and announcing device statute that would be constitutional. Those proposals never made it to the legislature for various reasons. It's my current understanding that some states have been successful in terms of just typical no-call legislation that may or may not include automatic dialing and announcing devices with just the political calls. But it's also my understanding that most of those cases are still pending appeal on the federal level.
And my final point is, in talking to legislative counsel and some attorneys who have been working on behalf of our office, as to the Oregon constitutional issue, their analysis was the Oregon Supreme Court found the previous law, as you mentioned, unconstitutional in part because it exempted political and charitable automated dialing. And, of course, this bill doesn't make that distinction. And it bars the use of ADADs for any purpose that is therefore content neutral. The Oregon Supreme Court also suggested the legislature might make a similar statute permissible if it were to focus on the adverse effect or harm rather than on the content of the communication itself, and that seems to be what we're trying to navigate here.
Chair Metzger, I would like to preface this with the fact that I am not a constitutional lawyer, and so it's been a while since I've read the opinion, but just from the standpoint of what the opinion ultimately resulted in, we feel that the proposal you've set forth, which is the joint resolution to also amend the Constitution, is in sort of bottom line speak, is the best bet.
Questions? Senator Zurich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming up here with us today. If you could explain to me the interaction between the no-call or the do-not-call lists by the federal government and the state government, and how it relates to automated calling machines?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, our Oregon no-call law, when it was being enforced before the federal preemption, dealt with solicitations. So the no-call law could be enforced against an automatic dialing and announcing device call to somebody who was on the no-call list, the Oregon no-call list at that time, but only to the extent that they were soliciting something. They were either selling a product to you or soliciting you for contributions for various entities, et cetera.
How about the federal legislation? How does that deal with automated calls? If I opt into that no-call list, am I exempted then from automated calls?
Again, it's Chair Metzger, Senator George, it's been a while since I've looked at the federal statute on no-call, but if I recall, it too is centered at least around solicitations. So it's my belief, and I'll double-check on that for you, it's my belief that the federal law also exempted calls that weren't based on solicitations to sell you a product. I believe the federal law even has a more broad charitable exemption than the Oregon law had. So if they were calling you for charitable solicitations, it may not be a violation of federal no-call.
So you sort of answered my question, but for instance, on my phone, I get quite a few automated calls on mortgage bankers and brokers and those kind of things. Your understanding is that if I opted into the federal system, which I've chosen not to do, but if I opted into the federal system, that those automated callers could not call my home.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, again, as it would depend on how that call is it would depend on how the language of that call is set forth, but if the intent is to sell you that product, to sell you on a mortgage, yes, that's my belief.
Thank you.
And again, I'll double check on that for you.
Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Scholl. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's ask Moses Ross to come forward. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. First off, I just want to say, this is a fantastic idea of having the youth here involved in this process. It's very exciting, and I hope that they glean some good things from the process. So,
great. Thank you. Make your name. And
My name is Moses Ross. I live in Portland, Oregon. I have a company, an Oregon-based company, that does political robocalls, appropriately called politicalrobocalls.com. And I wanted to share my knowledge base with the committee as far as the appropriate and ethical use of robocalls and some of the regulations that govern these types of robocalls as far as I understand them. I would submit to the committee that two further exemptions, obviously you're regulating automated calls, requiring the consent of the person unless called for a legitimate purpose, business, public safety, or school-related matters. I respectfully submit to the committee that two further exemptions be considered. First, the use of automated calls for political, nonprofit, and membership communications, and second, for the use of surveying and polling of the general public. These exemptions would fall in line with current federal regulation of automated calling and would not restrict freedom of speech. They would remain focused on the real challenge I feel is being addressed by this proposed legislation, that is the use of these calls for unwanted telephone solicitations. The other would ask voters to allow a change in the Oregon Constitution to specifically ban them. Before passing judgment on the need for such extreme measures, such as banning them entirely, I encourage you to learn the facts. Robocalls are categorized as automated telemarketing calls and are already regulated by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Communication Commission, the FCC. Rules were adopted that require anyone making these calls to provide their name, the name of the person or entity on whose behalf the call is being made in both the message and in the caller ID, and a telephone number or address at which that person or entity can be contacted. They don't allow calls to cell phones, and they prohibit calls between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. Consumers can register their phone number with a national do not call list registry, and you're not permitted to make sales calls to those that have registered.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Calls are not allowed between what hours?
8 a.m. and 9 p.m.
I thought it was 9 p.m. to 8 a.m.
Very good point. I should say calls are allowed between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. I got the reverse. Thank you for clarifying. The fines are pretty stiff. Fines for noncompliance start at $500 per violation, tripled if it is shown that the caller willfully and knowingly violated the rules. Filing a complaint with the FCC does not prevent you from also bringing suit in state court as well. Exempt from these laws are for calls from nonprofits, nonprofit organizations, and political organizations such as candidates, elected officials, and political groups. They are exempt for political organizations because robocalls serve the same purpose as other forms of political communications, to educate and inform voters. Their low cost per contact allows for broader communication with those voters. They allow candidates that would not be able to afford traditional print or broadcast media because of limited budgets the ability to communicate directly with voters. They allow legislators to educate voters about pending legislation or to notify them of town hall meetings. In fact, robocalls qualify for franking, the term used for official communications between elected officials and their constituents. Also, automated calls are used to conduct surveys of memberships and of the general population. As I understand this legislation, these types of robo-polls would also be banned. Surveys such as these serve a public interest in helping legislators and groups better understand public opinion and therefore craft policy and practices that best serve the public. The bad rap that robocalls receive is because of the unethical use of these calls by political groups and their attack dog advocacy groups. If you look up robocalls in Google and review all the negative instances of robocalls, most of all, not all instances are from these types of groups that are misusing them. Our company follows a strict code of ethics. We did over 1 million calls in the 2006 election cycle, and all for Democrats, candidates, and causes. Not one was a negative call. We follow the federal regulations of calling between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. only, and we eliminate all cell phones from the call list. That is the proper use of a robocall. We would not accept negative broadcasts, and we remained in integrity with the existing federal regulations. If the companies and the candidates that used them ethically and within federal regulations, we wouldn't need to regulate them on a state level. Also, here in Oregon, we already have a way that you can stop receiving these calls, unlike broadcast or print political messages. Campaigns in Oregon get their phone numbers from the voter file. If you don't want to receive these calls, simply have your number removed from your record at your county elections office. I am also an advocate of providing an opt-out method to be included in all automated calls, either by providing the caller with a toll-free number to call to be included on a statewide do not call list or an internal do not call list, or by allowing the live caller to press a keypad to have their number immediately documented as no longer wishing to receive these types of calls from that particular campaign. I have no problem with the state requiring the same standards of disclosure as is required with broadcast or print political advertisements. That would be very appropriate. But banning them is wrong, and it takes us down a slippery slope of banning political speech. To expand on my testimony, I have brought some samples of some automated calls that will give you a view or an example of the breadth of these types of calls and how they are used best in the public interest. Ryan, I have on that file, there's five separate calls, and I have them marked accordingly.
Why don't we play one of them, just I want to kind of move on.
Sure. Okay. Here's the...
Hello, this is Edward Norton, the actor. Yeah, from Fight Club, American History X, The Illusionist, all those other ones. Why am I calling you? I'm calling to let you know that it is too late to mail in your ballot. Democracy's on the line in this election, so please... don't mail your vote in at this point. Make sure your vote gets counted by dropping off your ballot before the end of the day on Tuesday. You can get Dropbox locations and voter guides to the issues at busproject.org/vote. Thanks for helping take our democracy back.
what that was an example of a celebrity GOTV type call where the name recognition of the person doing the recording is high, so the likelihood of the person listening to it is high, and it's being done in a public interest.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. I got a number of questions for you.
Certainly.
From the last committee. I appreciate your testimony, and for full disclosure, I actually used Mr. Ross for get out the vote calls myself in the last week of the election and did a great job.
Thank you.
In that. A couple of things, though. You mentioned about integrity versus those that may not follow those same guidelines. And the problem is, under our Constitution, we can't discriminate against those who, say, use them one way versus the other way. In terms of disclosure, one of the things we have in 863 is about disconnecting that line, about not misrepresenting the caller ID, all of which is done nowadays. And under the Oregon Constitution, in fact, with our political mail, you don't have to put on it anymore. It has been ruled, who actually paid for a particular mailing. We used to have to put authorized and paid for by Rick Metzger or Bruce Starr. We don't have to do that anymore. And the same thing applies to these calls. So unless we amended the Constitution to allow some regulation where people would have to, I say at the very least, identify who they are, disconnect that line if you decide to hang up, not manipulate who it's coming from, how do we start cracking down on what I think we would agree would be unethical use of that type of procedure?
I think the impetus would, my personal opinion is that impetus needs to fall on the political groups and the political legislators that are using them to make sure that they maintain a code of ethics. I think that the companies also need to take responsibility in maintaining that same code of ethics. I can see the challenge of that, but I just worry that an outright ban takes us down a banning of political speech that we may not want to go down, that would open the doors for other types of bans, and that worries me.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Question, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions, if I could, Mr. Chair. You brought up an interesting point. I've also used robocall-type calls in campaigns that I've worked on, and I've actually found, and those tell me if this is your experience also, I've found that when robocalls first started, they were kind of a interesting thing, and they could be used effectively as a negative campaign tool, but now people are much wiser to them, and negative calls almost have a backlash because they're used. And it's actually, I've advised a lot of people that I work with in the political cycle, do not use automated calls in a negative way because it actually backfires on your campaign. Do you agree with that?
Very much so. Very much so. I found that the positive use of them, conveying a positive message, has a much greater effect on the voter. And the outcome of the reception of that call to the voter than any kind of a negative, because I think that that's a marketing-wide phenomenon. I think the electorate has gotten very jaded with the negativity of the campaigns, be it broadcast, be it print, or robocalls. So I would agree with that very much.
If I could quick, I can actually point to one campaign specifically where a robocall actually cost them the campaign. It just switched the numbers. But I want to talk about something. Remember a few years back there was some lawsuits down in Klamath Falls where that shut down the water down there. A lot of political posturing. And I was involved one time. We were frustrated because we were trying to figure out how to help the people down in Klamath Falls. And we had a lot of the lower-income, working-class folks who worked on farms who were being put out of the jobs because of the loss of the water, and it was devastating down there. Many of these families were just barely getting by. We looked for a way to be able to help those families down there, so I was involved in an organization, and we spent about $2,400 on robocalls, on automated calls, and we were able to raise $25,000 just calling people up and asking them to make a contribution to the Klamath Falls Food Bank. Mm-hmm. So we called people, and for $2,500 investment on our side, we raised $25,000 cash for the Klamath County Food Bank, and they were able to leverage that into almost $250,000 worth of food for the families in Klamath Falls. And it was one of those examples where people don't like automated calls, but that was one example where we helped literally hundreds of families who did not have food using these machines, and I'm sure that you have similar stories on how helping nonprofits and helping get out some information was incredibly helpful. And I don't know if you had some of those stories that you might be able to share with us.
I think the best example that I can share of that is in the advocacy work. I had a client that needed to get the good word out about some pending legislation, and we did a series of what are called patch-through calls, where the voter can press a keypad and be immediately transferred to a legislator's office to give their opinion on pro or con on a particular form of legislation. We found that the people that responded after doing follow-up with those folks were not normally people that would have been engaged in the process. And so from the perspective of being able to reach out, I think it served a very great purpose. Also, there's new technology now which allows for web-based conference calls where the initial call-out is done via robocall to a large constituency, say a rural area, and they can press a keypad and be immediately transferred into a common conference call. And that conference call can hold up to 2,000 people, and the legislator can then in turn discuss issues with them. So that means that that person in the rural area doesn't have to travel to go to a conference call to learn more about pending legislation with that legislator. They can just, from the comfort of their home, participate in a statewide or a regional conference call to learn more about pending legislation. So, and as I understand it, this bill would ban that. And so I'm very concerned about that this new technology would be limiting the political participation of voters.
One last follow-up for you. You hit on a point that I think is key in all this. People don't like the annoyance of campaigns generally. They don't like the campaign lawn signs we put up. They don't like the mail that comes in their mailboxes. They don't like the live callers that call their houses. But one of the things that interests me is that these bills do not address political campaigns that are made by a live person. And you talked about low cost. And here's one of the things that I think is important. Incumbents primarily can raise lots of money, and challengers cannot. And I'm sure you've had experience in this arena. A live caller, in my experience, is about anywhere from $1 to $3 a call, depending on the complexity of the call. So for somebody who has a lot of money in their campaign war chest, that may be a viable way to get around this piece of legislation. But for small campaigns that are community-based and don't have a lot of money, automated calls have been a big opportunity for people who don't have as much money to actually be competitive with big-dollar campaigns. And I'm afraid the one low-cost tool that grassroots campaigns have to take on the political machines could be lost in this. This is the only tool that we have that is truly a low-cost tool that's accessible to everybody that allows average citizens to compete with big political organizations. And I was just wondering if you could kind of give us some feedback on that point.
Absolutely, and I agree 100%. One of the samples that I submitted for review was of a low-budget campaign. A woman was running for a district judge here locally or in the Portland metropolitan area. Was on a very limited budget. She was able to do a call out to potential voters and increase her name recognition because of that. She could not afford print. She could not afford broadcast media. Beyond those, it would have been very difficult for her to get the word out about herself and her very credible background. And in a 30-second period of time, we were able to reach, with a 30-second message, we were able to reach thousands of people that would not otherwise have heard of her. And for that, she was very grateful. So I agree with you. I feel that it limits to the big boys or to the incumbents, to those that have a lot of money, reaching out to voters.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much for this time.
Let's ask Victor Doom and Michael. Is it Shady? If I butchered it, please.
Duong.
Say it right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Metzger, thank you for having me.
Yes, big name.
My name is Victor Duong, and I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. First and foremost, I'd like to thank you for allowing a fraction of the student body to participate in this meeting. I think it's very important. I'm in general opposition of this this bill because I believe that automated phone calls serve a necessary part in society. But at the same time, I'm a little confused, so I pose a question to you. Which types of specific businesses are you looking to suppress and why?
Mr. Duong, first of all, it is the way the legislation is, 863, it does not prohibit any business from using that if you have consented, which is follows similar language to the current no-call list. So, for example, if you have a business relationship with a bank or a credit union or whatever, then you have established by a basis of this bill, as under the same current no-call list, a relationship with that particular institution, and they may solicit you because of that relationship. And as we previously mentioned, it also exempts emergency school and other types of contact. What it seeks to eliminate is if you do not desire to have that contact, you have not given your permission for them to occupy your phone line, that until such time that you have agreed to do that, this is 863 would make the automated use of contacting you illegal.
Thank you.
All right, so, Chairman Metzger and committee, I'm Michael Scatti, and I'm a senior here at Milwaukee High School. I'm opposed to this bill because, for the most part, because I believe that automated phone messages or calls play a pivotal role in getting especially young voters in America involved in voting and politics and keeping them informed on political issues. The automated phone call from Edward Norton is one that I actually received and that I know is a big one that helps get the young Americans who are very low in percentage in voting in America, helps to get them more of them to vote, and I think that's very important.
Well, thank you very much for that. Let me ask you a question. In the instance that you received, and you thought that was actually helpful to you, and Mr. Norton identified himself and what he was doing, and in the files of information that we have and continue to get, also differentiates between others who use that same technology. I would ask you, for example, should an automated caller, in your view, should they be required to identify who they are? Should they be required to have you have an option to contact them back? In other words, should they be allowed to manipulate a caller ID so that you don't know where the call originated from? Do you believe that there should be some regulation in that arena, or can the current law, which allows them to be anonymous for you not to know the origination of that, still be allowed? Do you see any regulation that should be required there?
I do think there should be regulation required there so you know who it is. They should be required to give you information of how you can contact them back. However, I don't think they should be completely not allowed to for any reason.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Jones? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lance McDonald, Paul Hubbard. By the way, I got to ask a question. You know, this is full disclosure. Do you guys get extra credit for testifying?
All right. Yeah.
Welcome. Whoever would like to start.
Oh, okay. I'm Lance McDonald. I am from Milwaukee, Oregon. And I feel I'm against this because I feel like it only limits these smaller campaigns in the end who are trying to put out their ideas, because higher budgeted campaigns will just find the money to get the phone calls out with individuals. And I also think that in the end, it's just more money that is being used for an issue that really all you have to do is hang up the phone. And you don't, it shouldn't, I don't feel like it should be on a that big of an issue.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I have one question for you on your last comment, because about hanging up the phone. One of the issues that has brought frustration to folks is that some of the, and I will use the word unethical, use of the automatic dialing devices, and this has been particularly problematic in a number of states, and certainly has been utilized here in Oregon, but I can't tell you how commonplace that is. It's where the phone does not disconnect. In other words, it leaves your line open. So when you hang up, the line is still open for a period of time, which is one of the, so that you can't get other information. And part of the bill at 863 is to require that it disconnect within 10 seconds of when you disconnect. I don't know if you've had that experience, and that's a technical thing, which I have no knowledge of, other than they do have the ability to basically tie your phone line up and prohibit other contact. Do you think that is something that should be regulated?
Yeah, I think so, because that's, if it's going on to your phone bill, that's something that should be taken care of. If you're not actually talking to them, then that should be regulated for sure.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Paul Hubbard, and I am generally for this bill because my family does not have a house phone. We all carry cell phones, and we're on a family plan where we have about 1,200 minutes a month, and we usually are really close to that 1,200 minutes, and time spent, the minutes wasted by these phone calls can take us over that limit and cost us money that I don't think we should have to pay because it's something we didn't wish to receive in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you actually gotten automated messages on your cell phones?
Yeah, we've gotten calls. I've never actually gotten a message because I usually just answer.
You had automated ones on your cell phone?
Yeah.
So interesting.
Political campaign system.
Gotcha. Thank you very much.
Actually, it was a ride from my office that got one yesterday on a cell phone for a free trip to Vegas. And I actually had received that on my landline, that one, a week or so ago when I got on a cell phone. So thank you, gentlemen, very much. Jeff Brackett and, let's see, I have another list. But Jeff, go ahead, come on up. Oh, he had the list. Okay. I had another list. I got to see where I put it, the supplementary one. Yeah, I have her. Elise Brown, why don't you go ahead and come up while I find what I did with my supplementary list. I was surprised to see your name on the list. This could be interesting.
Well, good afternoon. Members of the committee, Senator Metzger, Elise Brown representing Singular Wireless, the new AT&T, and apologize, I was talking shop with DOJ in the back of the room. And I wanted to say, too, as a mother of a high schooler, what a great opportunity it is for the students here at Milwaukee High School. I hope that they get a chance to come down and see the real action down in the Capitol. We are looking at Senate Bill 863 also, and just for the sake of the record, we do have some concerns and hope to work with you going forward to clarify a couple of these things. First of all, just starting out and dittoing some of the earlier testimony, we are wondering what the need for the bill is. Pointing out again that there's federal laws already in place to handle a lot of these issues around the auto dialers, and those are the automated messaging, telemarketing, and the do not call list. Senator George was raising some questions about the FCC issues and the federal law, and I did bring, which I didn't bring copies for everybody, but I'm happy to circulate it to each of you on Monday, but there is an unwanted telephone marketing call list that goes through all of the protections that consumers have now. So again, why do we need the bill? But if the committee is interested in moving this forward, we would respectfully ask that the committee consider Oregon law being consistent with what's already in place at the federal level. I do want to point out the one sticking point for singular, and that is the definition of established business relationship. One of the things that's important to us in our business is being able to contact our customers about important information that impacts their service. One of the things that we explain to our customers through the privacy policy is just the ability to get a hold of them. Some of the things that you may have all noticed as wireless customers is an opportunity to pay your bill online, pound pay, you know, some of those things that we share with our customers, and those are the messages that they get. In the event that they don't want to be contacted by Singular, then they have an ability to take themselves off of a list, and that's easily done. But again, getting back to that definition, the way it's worded in the bill would preclude us from getting a hold of them unless we have their permission to do so. So again, I brought some language that we hope that the committee would consider going forward that would allow us to reach our customers, all of them, without going back to millions and asking permission to speak to them going forward. So with that, I'll close my testimony. And again, I am happy to circulate this FCC consumer facts to you all next week.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brown. A couple of things. First of all, the material here isn't really covered at all by federal because this clearly is designed at political calls, which are exempt under all federal. They're not preempted, but they're not part of the list. And so... And the language of the bill is designed to replicate the current no-call list for all the other business practices, but to be able to include the political prohibition, which does not currently exist. I had a question, though, regarding contacting your subscribers. And, you know, they contact me on a regular basis. You know, got to get your check in, Rick, this week, please. pay your bill, yeah. But on Section 2, it says that the caller has an established business relationship with the subscriber, which we took from the no-call list already. And so I'm just curious as to how that, when you say you have difficulty to contact your subscribers, doesn't that cover it? Because it seems to cover it under the current Oregon and federal no-call list for businesses. That's on line 1, page 2 of the bill.
Sure. And the way that we were looking at that is the problem with the language is that we have to receive prior consent from customers to contact them, even if we have an established business relationship. So when you look at the definition that you have in the bill, and I'm sorry, I'm not looking at Section 1, but I'm looking at Item 5 under Section 1, mm-hmm. It does not allow for existing relationship. It talks about previous relationship. So again, if we are misinterpreting, then I apologize, but I'm looking at an established business relationship that allows for an existing relationship. The way we look at it is that we would have to go back to millions of customers to get their consent to continue to send messages to them.
Well, we'll definitely look at that and make sure that's clarified because that's certainly not the intent, so we'll check on that. I had another question for you, though, being primarily in the wireless category.
Mm-hmm.
And that is currently there has not been a plethora of political calls going to cell phones because people have not generally been using those phones on their voter registration forms, et cetera. And the business relationships, currently the no-call list doesn't involve cell phones. But since there is no political coverage at all or exemption, protection at all, as political groups get more sophisticated and they get other lists that do have cell phones as the primary one, and they start checking those against voter lists, so they have a more inclusive list.
Mm-hmm.
And the time comes, because there is no exemption, that we start getting a lot of these same political calls on our cell phones. Now, that's a different situation, because you are going to charge me for that message.
That's correct.
Even though I have not authorized it and I have to play that, or they text or wherever, I am now incurring a fee. We have a couple pieces of testimony that people sent to the committee about that. I'm actually being charged for this invasion of my privacy, and I can't do anything about that. And I would imagine a company like yours, you know, moving forward, and this becomes commonplace, we'll probably be receiving a lot of complaints from customers about that, which then becomes the customer complaint issue
right.
for you. So I'm curious as to how the company would view that, because it's not just an invasion of privacy in that situation, but your customers wouldn't be happy about having to to be charged for those calls?
Mr. Chair, you're asking me to look into my crystal ball, I think. I would tell you that right now, federal law protects all wireless customers from any robocalls. So if that ever happens, and actually I think my son has told me at one point that he did get a solicitation, and that is illegal. So there's protections now in the federal law.
But does that cover political speech?
It covers political speeches. There's absolutely, under federal law now, there is no solicitation except for the company. And again, those are the messages that we send our customers, and those are not charged for. Those are paid for by the company. So if you receive any kind of solicitation on your cell phone that's not from your wireless provider, they're in violation, and that needs to be dealt with by the FCC.
Well, that's very interesting because that would, you know, get back to the definition of solicitation as opposed to informational or education. That's very interesting.
And again, all of this is clarified in the FCC Consumer Facts, which I quickly pulled it offline before I came out here today, but I will hand that to you on Monday and
you'll see that. Thank you very much. Our questions for Ms. Brown. And I bet you got to stay in Portland today, didn't you?
I did. I picked a nice day to do that. So did you.
Thank you very much. Alana Castro and Jennifer Miller. Excuse me?
I'm Alana Castro.
Hi, Alana. Have a seat and chat with us.
Okay. Hi, my name is Alana Castro, and I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. As a high school student and as one who does not get to spend a lot of time at home, I often find myself relying on my cell phone to keep in contact with those around me, with my friends, to keep track of meetings and things like that. Also, in keeping track with my parents. And I see this as a necessary step that needs to be taken in order to help protect us and keep allowing us to choose what we want to do, whether or not we want to receive these calls or whether or not we wish to be included in things like that. So I am definitely in favor of this because I see this as just another step in, as technology increases and people are finding more and more ways to contact people, I see the need for regulation within this area. And I commend you on your choice of choosing to start regulating this and in taking necessary steps that our citizens perhaps don't always see because it's an everyday annoyance, but something that will perhaps become a problem more and more in the future.
Thank you, Alana. Jennifer.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Miller. I go to the school. I live here in Milwaukee, chairman and committee. I'm quite for this because not only is this thing becoming quite of annoyance, but at my home we generally get, like, on a very, very rare day we'll get none, but we generally get between at least 5 to 15 every day. Like,
wow,
we get a lot of them. Like, main problem I have with that, and the reason why I think this is quite a good idea, is because at home I live with both my grandparents and my grandfather for the last almost a year. He's been having a lot of health problems. So whenever he can get sleep, he needs it. The main problem that I've been seeing with it is the fact that it's always interrupting. Like, we get them all through the evening until the 9 o'clock deadline. I don't remember ever getting one past then because nobody's allowed to use the telephone in our house at that point in time. They're always waking up my grandfather. I've gotten the ones that are, like, the telemarketers for, like, the free trips and stuff. I've gotten the ones for campaigns. I've gotten ones asking us to call mortgages, things to go up for a better thing, even though we've got the best we can get. Same thing for credit cards. And it's an annoyance because it makes it a lot harder on my grandfather's health. And with the whole entire thing with that you were talking about earlier, with the thing where some of them in Oregon keep on don't turn immediately off on their end when we hang up. That also poses a problem because when we do get phone calls, it's usually, not including my sister's phone calls, which are always from her boyfriend, it's always from out in Bend. So that would be posing problems because they'd be blocking them off because think that might be part of the reason why we haven't really gotten any phone calls from my great uncle over in Bend, because he hasn't called. He's only called back once in the last 6 months. So he hasn't been able to get through. So I really think this is a good idea.
Thank you, Jim. Questions for these ladies?
Real quickly.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, you really might want to check into the no-call list at the federal level. Mm-hmm. You can do it online.
My main problem with it is the fact that it's almost always the exact same ones over and over.
Yeah, I think if you file with the no-call folks at the federal level, you can probably block a lot of that stuff from going on. You might go online or ask your teacher, and I think you'll probably be able to find out. It'll probably help you out quite a bit if you're having that many solicitation calls.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really, you can get, especially for certain age group demographics, and your grandparents are in that age group demographic, a lot of solicitations really solicit those folks for those types of things you're describing. If you're on no call list, then solicitations can't be made to your house, and you might try to do that. I talk to your teacher and see if they can't find a website for that.
Yes, because that'd be useful, because my grandparents know absolutely nothing about computers. I'm the computer guru in the household.
I'd try that. Thank you very much for testifying today, both of you.
I have the same problem with computers. The younger people I run into, the smarter they are. I mean, it just takes away everything you've always learned about education. Any other questions for these two ladies? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Erica.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Erica Dakota. I live here in Milwaukee, and I'm a sophomore here at Milwaukee High. I would just like to start off by saying that I am entirely opposed to this bill, because when it gets right down to it, it's a, it's not about political messages. It's not about business. It's about a free speech issue. And as annoying and obnoxious and unwanted and unsolicited as many of these robocalls are, you cannot deny that they have a right to do what they're doing. We live in Oregon, one of the, if not the most, First Amendment-friendly and, dare I say, liberal states in the nation. And here we are subjected daily to numerous types of unwanted, annoying, obnoxious, even sometimes vulgar, and inappropriate speech and advertisements and those types of things. And so I'm opposed to this bill because I feel that if we are going to have these types of messages allowed, some kind of things that might offend people, even that these robocalls are probably the least of our worries. They are a very, very minor inconvenience when you really think about it compared to some of the things that we see. As Mr. I forgot his name. He testified earlier from the politicalrobocalls.com.
Mr. Moses.
Mr. Moses, yes, thank you. he said that by placing a blanket ban on most types of automated phone calls, we're beginning a slippery slope of banning all types of political speech. I very much agree with that. It may not seem like it now, but I really feel that that is what could happen. Just by banning these phone calls. I also know that there are some concerns among voters and constituents that robocalls from politicians and candidates are impersonal and not good enough, not really the way to go about communicating with constituents. And I feel that that is an issue that cannot be solved simply by banning automated telephone calls. It's an issue that needs to be taken up by those voters with their politicians. They can't expect the legislature to take care of that problem for them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Erica. I have one question for you. You brought up the issue of freedom of speech, which is a real key issue in the debate on a topic like this. And that is, and here's the question I pose to you, is we have a very broad definition of freedom of speech in Oregon, as you mentioned, even broader than, and depending on what the issue is, we either are very glad about that, or if it's something that we're not very happy about, we can't believe that that is covered by it. But where do we draw the line between someone's freedom of speech and your freedom of privacy to not have to listen? And it's called in law, time, place, and manner. You can regulate time, place, and manner so that on a street corner we can't tell someone they can't solicit or free speech, but you don't have to walk by them. But at home, it is your private home. We've always considered that very private, that privacy of your own home can't be invaded, and yet now the speech comes in where you don't have an alternative. How do you kind of, in your mind, balance where does the freedom of speech end and your right to privacy in your home begin?
It's my understanding that there are, a few do not call, registries, you can unlist your phone number, you can do all that. But I think that as long as you're making your information available, I don't want to say you're asking for it because certainly not, these calls are unsolicited, but it can't be too much of an inconvenience if you're not taking the time to make sure that that problem is taken care of. I don't feel that it's all that much of an invasion of privacy. The manner through which these robocalls are contacting people, phone numbers, that's a matter of public record. It's not an invasion of privacy.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you so much.
I just want to see if I can make a comment. That was one of the most articulate conversations on constitutional law we have had in this committee this entire legislative session. So very impressed, actually. Thank you very much.
Very impressed with the testimony. Yeah. Now, that's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else that would wish to testify who has since thought where they wish they would put their name on the list? We have a few minutes to hear from you if you'd like. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I will echo what Senator George said. I think that in both our morning session and afternoon, we've had a lot of very probing questions and thoughts about these issues. And hopefully you get a feel for some of the things that we will deal with. We're various committees, 8 to 12 of these a day in committee of all types of different issues, totally unrelated, in which we have those same questions that you do. And we're probing issues that that we don't necessarily have particular expertise in, and we rely on others just like you to pose those questions and try to find the answers to. This one is particularly fascinating because it has tremendous popular support, but there's also tremendous questions that have to be answered about, what is the right role of this and our privacy rights and our free speech rights, and how does Oregon's Constitution weigh against that? And you really captured the controversial issues and what is the line that you draw in protecting privacy and protecting the right to have conversations. So. Committee, this has just been a great day to hear from these kids. You've added a great contribution to this discussion. We passed one bill in the morning, another bill we heard, and we're going to be deliberating on. These sets of bills, we'll deliberate on them and see where we might go with them, or if there may just be parts of it that we might want to pursue based on a lot of the input that you gave us today. So we appreciate that very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearings on SJR 33 and Senate Bill 683. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.